Welcome back to another episode of Bitch Radio. I'm Sherston Johnson, the web content manager and senior editor at Bitch Media. The third annual Roots of Change Conference on Social Justice and Media is coming to Portland, Oregon a week from now, on November 2nd through the 4th. And this week, I had the pleasure of speaking to two of the conference's keynote speakers. Dr. Rachel Griffin and Joshua Phillips are partners whose work as both advocates and academics centers around gender violence. Rachel and Josh see pop culture as a way to both examine and teach messages about gender violence and social justice. They even do a session together on the song Love the Way You Lie, a collaboration between Rihanna and Eminem. I spoke with Rachel and Josh separately and then edited their answers together. We discussed their work, how they approach pop culture as a pedagogical tool, some recent music videos that address gender violence, and their methods of reaching out to others about awareness.
My name is Dr. Rachel Alicia Griffin, and I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Speech Communication at Southern Illinois University at Carbondale. And for me, being a professor in a speech comm department is a little bit different than what I think folks might imagine. The area that I'm in is intercultural communication, but even more particular, critical intercultural communication. So I do a great deal of work with critical race theory, black feminist thought, black masculinity, popular culture, and of course, gender violence. So all of my work really circles around ideas of power, privilege, and voice, whether it's through the courses that I teach, like for example, right now I'm teaching a black feminist thought course, or if it's through giving particular keynotes, or if it's through the research that I'm doing. It all definitely can be understood in relation to what, according to different dominant ideologies and dominant discourse, is considered everything that's politically incorrect to talk about out loud and to challenge and to resist.
My name is Joshua Daniel Phillips. Currently, I'm a PhD student at Southern Illinois University. My research interests in particular deal with issues of gender violence, specifically how men and men's groups are trying to approach gender violence, and how men's activism can really set up a model that is inclusive around gender and sexual differences, as opposed to reinstating or recentering patriarchal influences. A lot of the work I do outside of the academy, I'm a national speaker. I probably speak about 5 or 6 times a year all over the country at different schools about issues of gender violence, and more specifically, talk a lot about in 2008, myself and two colleagues of mine, we walked from Miami to Boston in order to raise awareness about sexual violence. And this walk took us 3 months, and we met a lot of great people along the way. We heard a lot of really inspiring stories. And when I got back, I finally went ahead and decided to sit down for a couple months and write my experiences out in a book that's titled 1800 Miles, Striving to End Sexual Violence One Step at a Time. So now I kind of use that book as a catalyst to illustrate to individuals how I try to engage in activism on an everyday level, and really hope to inspire college students and community members to figure out their own little spaces, how they can be involved in this issue just on a daily basis. So I'm just really try to be encouraging and get folks to get involved with this issue on just like the small micro everyday realities that surround them.
Well, I think it's really interesting that you use pop culture to talk about gender violence. Could you sort of give an overview about how that works for you both?
I understand pop culture as this pedagogical tool that teaches all of us lessons about sexual assault, domestic violence, and really sort of these greater gender roles that we're asked to perform every day. And so as a teacher at a university, and as a person who goes out into communities and gives talks, I try to situate pop culture as this huge influence in our everyday lives. And so by better understanding pop culture as a means to tell us how to perform these different gender roles, I think pop culture is accessible to everyone. Everyone can resonate with some aspect of pop culture. And at the same time, as we deconstruct pop culture, we can get a better understanding of why we act certain ways, why we behave in certain ways, how we're influenced in certain ways, the different ways in which we perpetuate stereotypes or prejudice or gender roles. And the more we can understand pop culture, we'll have a better understanding of how and why we treat different people in different ways in our everyday interactions.
For me, you know, one of the things you had in your email is this idea of a feminist response to popular culture. And I want to expand that a little bit because I want to shift that to feminists, so in the plural, not only responding to pop culture, but also deconstructing pop culture and challenging pop culture and using pop culture as a pedagogical or a teaching tool. Right. So one of the things that I think about is someone who teaches on a campus and is very much, you know, in the realm of undergraduate students on a consistent basis, is that not only is U.S. American society saturated with pop culture, but because in terms of my own gender violence activism, most of it is campus based, you know, I see on a daily basis how saturated their lives are with popular culture. So to approach pop culture from a critical intercultural or a critical feminist standpoint for me means to absolutely recognize that pop culture is always more than just entertainment. I know that from a student perspective, oftentimes the reaction I get when we start deconstructing pop culture and really looking to challenge and critique and locate the isms is, oh my gosh, you know, Rachel, or oh my gosh, Dr. Griffin, it is just a film, or it's just a song, or it's just a movie.
Yep.
You know, and my response is that, yes, it can be entertainment, but it is far more than just entertainment. So not only is it pervasive, but pop culture isn't entertainment and it isn't innocent because it teaches us things. And for me, it's not about whether or not we decide to engage with pop culture. Like, do we decide to sit down and read Cosmopolitan magazine, or do we decide to listen to hip hop, or do we decide to listen to country music, or do we decide to watch whatever the latest and greatest, you know, hot show is? It's not about if we decide to watch it or not, or if we decide to engage it or not, or if we like it or if we don't. What it's really about is the complexity in that very moment of how are we making those choices. So I always teach my students and, you know, various audiences when it comes to educating about pop culture that I'm not here to ask you not to watch pop culture or to ask you not to play particular video games. I want you to come to a point of consciousness about the choices that you're making. So why do you like it? What role does it play in your life? What does it teach you about who you are, and what does it teach you about who other people are? So for me, it's all about getting to that conscious space where we can engage in pop culture mindful of the influence that it's having. I want us to actively engage with pop culture. So I'm okay with the omnipresence of pop culture. I just want active, conscious engagement.
Great. Yeah, I mean, it's not like pop culture is going away or you can't ignore it, really.
Precisely, right? And when I first heard the Roots of Change call, I have to tell you that I was ecstatic, you know, like fall out of my seat, oh my gosh, this is great, ecstatic, because oftentimes, in terms of anti-gender violence advocacy, we get really, from my perspective, pigeonholed into conversations about prevention and education. And when I say pigeonholed, I don't mean that those two things aren't important. Prevention and education are crucial, but from my perspective, we've got to expand what prevention and education look like in a society that's media saturated, particularly once we start to position pop culture as being pedagogical and far more as entertainment. Then we really crack open into that rich space of, like, well, gosh, like, how do our students learn about gender norms? Right? And how do our students learn about sex and sexuality and consent and, you know, all of these issues that are so closely tied to gender violence? So I was thrilled because having an entire conference focused on pop culture and media is very much, I think it's necessary and it's been long in coming, but I hope that we start to see that kind of trend in different places, or at least spaces in the pre-existing conferences that might focus on institutions other than media, where media is welcome to be brought into that conversation as both a site where gender violence can be reproduced, or some of the norms that support gender violence can be reproduced. But I would also love to see us doing more things like this, creating a podcast where we can use different forms of pop culture and social media to resist gender violence.
Mm-hmm. And because you engage with men and boys, I assume, are there certain, what, as far as pop culture, do you use uniquely when speaking to men about gender violence?
There's a group that I'm involved with on my own campus at Southern Illinois University known as Progressive Masculinities Mentors. And what I really think that this group is sort of set apart in a way from other men's groups I've been involved with is this group doesn't try to, it's not a top-down approach. It's very grassroots. It's very much allows every member within the organization to kind of bring in their own pop culture critiques and bring in their own criticism of pop culture. So we'll talk about everything from sports to hip-hop music to things that we read in the newspapers, and there's a very diverse range of opinions. So you have individuals who have never been engaged in dialogue about gender violence before, but they're really into football or they're really into basketball. And we can start having conversations about sports, and through these conversations about sports, we can slowly introduce them to ways in which gender is performed on the field. We can slowly introduce them to ways in which gender is reproduced through musical lyrics. But we really try to meet men where they're at. And where we find men at is in these various stereotyped positions. We find men want to talk about sports, and we find men want to talk about music, specifically hip-hop and rap music, with the guys that I try to engage with on an everyday basis. And so just meeting guys where they're at and understanding that they have these outlets, and these outlets are their educational experience, I think that does a lot, as opposed to trying to go in and just from a top-down approach and trying to get guys to understand these big concepts, these big academic or scholarly terms, or, you know, even using the word like feminism or feminist criticism. You know, that can sometimes wash over men in this way that they don't comprehend, they don't understand, or a way in which makes them feel marginalized or attacked. So going in and just allowing men to sort of have these organic conversations about the ways in which they see gender performed in their everyday realities, and then near the end start to dig a little bit deeper and get into some more critical dialogues about what does it mean to be a man in certain instances, I think is really, really helpful.
As someone who's really in the field of gender violence and education, Rachel, you mentioned that a lot of people don't talk about pop culture and media, and I'm wondering what else you see sort of lacking and missing from more of the mainstream conversations about gender violence.
Oh, goodness. For me, the first thing that comes to mind that's both related to pop culture and I think equally as important is this concept of intersectionality. I think an intersectionality coming out of Kimberly Crenshaw, who's a critical race theorist scholar, and also coming very much out of second wave feminism, right? So folks like Gloria Anzaldúa and Audre Lorde and, you know, bell hooks, they've been talking about intersectionality for quite some time. I think that we've gotten better at including the word intersectionality. It's at least in our everyday conversations for the most part at the ground level around prevention and education. But I don't know that we've gotten to the point where we embody an idea of intersectionality when it comes to anti-gender violence activism. And what I mean by that is by not just mentioning the intersections of identity, such as gender, race, sexual orientation, class, ability, age, size, and so forth, are significant. I think that we have to take it a step further and really push ourselves to be reflexive around this idea that not only do the intersections of our identities matter in terms of how we reach out to survivors and how we resist cultural norms that fuel gender violence, but we also have to build the intersections into things like brochures and programs. And we have to consider intersectionality when we look at the advocacy groups that we're building and when we look at the different communities that we're trying to reach into and access. So while I think it's being mentioned and talked about, which is a very important shift, I think that I would love to see on a more wide scale level it being implemented, built into the ways that we move through activism in this movement.
Do you have an example of where that you see that either working really well of a group or a person who's doing that well?
You know, just last week in Baltimore, I spoke at the Women of Color Network Conference for MCASA, which is the Maryland Coalition Against Sexual Assault. And just the fact alone that they have a Women of Color Network Conference, right? Like that title, I think, says something to me. Mm-hmm. And it's designed around talking about the intersections of race and gender in relation to gender violence. Spaces like that, I think, are crucial. And not just in terms of race and gender, I think we need to do, You know, we need multiple combinations. Like, we can't account for all intersections at any given moment, right? Like, there's no way to build in absolutely every intersection to every panel, every program, every keynote, every course, so on and so forth. But what we can do is make sure that we're being attentive to particular intersections explicitly, and then also being accountable to why it is that we're not engaging in other intersections explicitly. And then to do some, I like to think about it as checking in on which intersections we do really well. Like, using myself as an example, I do race, gender, class, and sexual orientation fairly well, realizing that I'm always in progress, always learning more about my own social consciousness, right? So I don't want to claim perfection, like, oh my gosh, I've got the intersections of these things down. And to be even more transparent, I do race and gender much better than I do race, gender, class, or race, gender, and sexual orientation, or all four taken together. But that also tells me that I have to work really hard to be inclusive around religion and nationality and ability and so on and so forth, right? Just being transparent about what are we doing well and maybe what are we not doing well, to make sure that as people involved in the advocacy in our everyday lives, that we're also being accountable the ways that we're asking our audiences to be accountable.
Well, I know you do a session, and you're going to do the session at the upcoming Roots of Change conference about Love the Way You Lie, the Eminem and Rihanna song that came out last summer. Are there other, either like pop culture or media stories or tropes out there right now that you also think provide a compelling take on gender violence?
When Love the Way You Lie came out, I was mortified, right? I want to be transparent about that. My initial reaction was like, jaw to the floor, you've got to be kidding me. Because the co-authored piece that Josh and I have, we critique it pretty heavily in terms of the ways that it reproduces norms that reproduce men's violence against women and market as something that is acceptable. So we do a very critical critique of the song. Now, the song does have, I think, progressive potential. I mean, even just the fact that the song puts, on a grand mediated scale, gender violence out into public discourse as a topic for conversation, I think can be positive, because in that moment it can be utilized as a teaching tool. Another song that I think is important to pay attention to that is also a recent song is housed more so in the realm of country, and that's Sugarland Stuck Like Glue, which I read from a critical standpoint as a music video that reproduces norms around stalking as acceptable, and also raises really interesting discussion points, because in the video, the person stalking is a female and the person being stalked is a male. You see a woman watching a male outside of what you can interpret as his home, and then she kidnaps him, and then she ties him up, and then she pours alcohol down his throat. And the whole time this is going on, the song itself I would describe as being very upbeat. And in the music video, the female is doing it with what I interpret as humor, right? Like, this is funny, this is fun, I'm in love with you, I'm stuck like glue.
And one thing that I thought was really interesting about this Sugarland song, in contrast with the Eminem Rihanna song, is that it does have this idea of stalking, of violence, of sort of forcing one person into a romantic relationship that he or she may not want to be involved with. But what it does is it trivializes the stalking incident, because it reverses the gender norms that were commonly taught to think about stalking. So one thing that I'm really fascinated with is the ways in which, if the gender roles are reversed and if a man is the victim of some sort of stalking incident, it's seen as comical, it's seen as buffoonery, it's seen as absurd, when really, you know, those instances can be just as detrimental. So now what I'm doing right now with some of my research is I'm trying to look at pop culture and the ways in which men who are survivors of domestic violence, of stalking, of sexual assault, the ways in which they are treated in pop culture. And so their experiences are often minimized. They're seen as some sort of joke or something to laugh at because it's so abnormal and not talked about. And I think their voices and their pain really gets marginalized. And so we also need to recognize that men are also victims and survivors of these horrific acts. And we need to start drawing attention to the ways in which their struggles and their pain are also serious. And so I think that Sugarland song really kind of brings attention to the ways in which we want to poke fun at, because of how absurd it might seem that a man be a victim of stalking. But when we start to do that, we really start to marginalize the everyday male experience of men who might be victims of some sort of gender violence. And so I think it's really important to start looking into these instances in order to see how male survivors of gender violence are processing through these experiences and how their voices might be taken more seriously.
Mm-hmm. Are there any promising or progressive sort of representations of men and gender violence that you see in popular media right now?
Yes. Give me a second to think of a few. I mean, nothing immediately pops to mind, which might be very, very telling. But I do think, I mean, I think we have these moments in pop culture, right, where every once in a while something will emerge that we see as progressive. And so I'm thinking about a few years back, this reference to the Ludacris song, the Runaway song, where Ludacris kind of makes this ode to women, talking about women being abused and how he wants women to kind of run away into his protection, et cetera, et cetera. I know Lil Wayne has a new song out that calls attention to domestic violence. I'm thinking about Tyler Perry's For Colored Girls, which is problematic in certain ways, but at the same time, it's one of the very few representations we have in pop culture that draws attention to sexual assault and domestic violence, specifically among African-American women. So I do think there are these sort of hints within pop culture that kind of rise up every couple years and really bring attention to the suffering and marginalized voices of women, and even more specifically, women of color.
Another recent example, and I struggle deeply with this example too because of the artist, Lil Wayne released a song called How to Love. And I read Lil Wayne critically as problematic in terms of the ways that he, through his music, I interpret him reproducing not only sexism, but also colorism, right, which has to do with the politics of light-skinned versus dark-skinned women. I think a great deal of Lil Wayne's music reproduces dominant ideologies around race, around gender, and so forth. Now, How to Love, oh my gosh, to be transparent, it completely took me off guard, right? Because I interpret How to Love as being a progressive representation of gender violence in a number of different ways. I think we can argue that it reproduces norms around gender violence as well, but I want to mark the ways that I think it can be interpreted as progressive. You have a black male hip-hop artist talking about experiences with gender violence that black women have over the course of a lifespan. So if you watch the film, you can see imagery or interpret imagery of domestic violence, of sexual violence, of a black woman who's contracted HIV, of abortion, so of a number of different, you know, issues related to gender and sexuality that black women encounter throughout their lives as women of color. And it really tells a narrative across generations where it begins in a very difficult place around a black woman deciding not to have an abortion. And in that moment, you can interpret that this black woman being pregnant is not, from her perspective, good news, all the way through at the end, generations later, a black woman being pregnant and it being a point of celebration. So it tells a very different story about how to love. It tells a very different story about how to love and how love looks and how love can happen. And I struggle because I don't want to say, you know, Lil Wayne is now progressive, but I do want to say that we have an example of a black male hip-hop artist who, from my interpretation, has created a pedagogical tool through pop culture that can be used to raise consciousness around gender violence, particularly at the intersections of race, gender, and also in many ways class.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting because I think a lot of times when, you know, people are talking about social justice through pop culture, I think a lot of people think it has to be either good or bad pop culture, like it's very cut and dry when actually there's things could be both a sign of progression as well as like problematic.
And sure.
It's really about.
And I also want to say, I think that's one of the spaces where I found the most ease in helping students critique pop culture is not taking a good-bad approach, but taking a both-and. Like, how can we read the text critically in terms of how it reproduces dominant ideologies and dominant stereotypes and how it resists dominant ideologies and dominant stereotypes. A great example is right now I'm teaching an undergraduate honors course on Disney and Disney animated film. And what we're doing in there is we literally go, you know, film by film or text by text and talk about how does Disney reproduce dominant ideologies? How does Disney contest dominant ideologies? I mean, Disney is one of the hardest things to help students critique oftentimes because they've grown up with it and they just simply love it, you know, myself included. But going through that both and or has been far more, from my perspective, productive than going through the either or door. And especially when we're talking about pop culture, you know, if we're talking about recent pop culture, we're probably talking about things that students absolutely love, right? Or absolutely identify with, which makes the both and much more productive than the either or. Because then it can become about critiquing the pop culture opposed to, you know, swearing it off. For some folks, that might be the answer that they come to. Like, I just can't engage with this pop culture anymore now that I understand, you know, what I'm, you know, both implicitly and explicitly supporting. For other folks, not engaging with a particular form of pop culture isn't an option because they so strongly identify with it. So there has to be an option for folks who perhaps don't perceive not engaging as a choice. And the choice that you can offer through both and is engage and deconstruct, engage and be conscious.
Well, one thing I was interested in is on your website it says you advocate that just because one doesn't have the answers doesn't mean that you should be indifferent. So can you talk a little bit about that and sort of how, you know, it's not, sometimes it's really just not good enough to be passive about something, and how do you reach out to people who maybe don't see themselves as gender violence advocates? And
I think a few stories that I might share with individuals who don't think of themselves as advocates or don't think that they have some sort of role to play. So specifically men who say, you know, this issue doesn't affect me or I don't know anyone, et cetera, et cetera. One story that I always sort of bring forth to them is that, you know, I was involved with this issue for 5 years. And finally, when I was about 24, 25, I went back home. I was hanging out with some friends from high school, and a really good friend of mine from high school came up to me and said, "Hey, Josh, I know this is what you are doing now, and I just wanted to tell you, you know, this tragic story of relationship abuse was going on while we were in high school." And in the back of my head, I'm thinking, you know, why didn't you tell me in high school? You know, we were such good friends, et cetera, et cetera. And I keep coming back to this moment of, you know, this individual felt so silenced because of the way that she felt she was going to be perceived, the ways in which she felt her friends were going to talk about her, and she didn't feel safe because of this cultural climate we created in order to silence victims of violence. And so I try to tell men, you know, no matter where you think you are on this issue or no matter how well you think you might know the women specifically in your life, there could be women in your own lives this moment who are survivors or who are going through some sort of dating violence relationship, and then they might not be telling you anything at all. It took me 5 years to be engrossed in this issue. And finally, a friend of mine came up who I'd been great friends with for a long time and told me her story. So what I tell men is that because we are surrounded by so many people in our lives, it's important for us to continue to do the work. And it doesn't mean that you're going to have a ton of friends rush into your door and telling you their stories. But what it does mean is that as you continually put yourself out there, you are going to continually showcase yourself as this progressive man who's trying to model change, who's trying to give the world a different view about what masculinity can mean. And the more you do that, the more comfortable an environment and culture you are going to create in order for survivors of gender violence to come forward and share their stories. So you might not hear a story the first year that you're engaged with it or the first 5 years you're engaged with it. But as long as you continue to help create a culture that elicits some sort of safe space where survivors of violence can come forward and feel like they are going to be listened to and feel as if they are going to be believed, then you are doing your part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, about audiences being accountable, do you have any advice for people who maybe don't consider themselves advocates but do feel like they need to do something about gender violence and how they can begin to work about these different levels of accountability?
I think it has to do with where individual people are in relation to their own consciousness. One of the hardest things that I struggled to learn initially and still grapple with on a regular basis is how to meet my audiences where they are and how to recognize the diversity that you're going to encounter in any given room. Not everyone is going to be open to this idea of activism. Not everyone's going to be willing to identify as an advocate. Not everyone's going to welcome this idea of feminism or being a feminist. So for me, when I think about how to reach some of those folks that are in different places around their own consciousness, I always try to start in a place of humility and do some thinking about where was I before I explicitly identified myself as an activist? And even though I identify as an activist, where are the spaces and places that my own privilege still prevents me from seeing different realities? So one of the shifts that I try to get folks to make, particularly folks who aren't ready to engage in activism or mark themselves as a feminist or mark themselves as somebody who is resistant, is to simply make the shift between reality to realities or from a possibility to possibilities. So this idea that there are more perspectives in the world and more experiences in the world than just your own. And something that I try to teach, which it is so much easier said than done for myself included, is this idea that really arriving to a space of interaction or conversation or dialogue with this idea that, and I'll use myself as an example, that my own identities and values and ideologies and beliefs and experiences are just as important as anyone else's. And oftentimes I found that to be an effective entry point for folks, perhaps not necessarily to join in the movement against gender violence, but to at least recognize that it is valuable. There has to be an entry point, and we know that entry points around guilt and shame, although guilt and shame around privilege are very much part of the process of becoming conscious, but guilt and shame in and of itself oftentimes isn't a door that people are willing to walk through to join into a movement. So for me, that door that I try to create, and really this is a very boiled down version of it, when it comes to gender violence, you know, one of the things I ask folks to consider in terms of survivors and, for example, accusations of false reporting, I don't go the route of you're absolutely wrong for thinking that a survivor might be making a false report or might be lying. Like, for me, that's absolutely wrong to do. But for another person, that reaction might make sense in their world. So instead of telling them that they're wrong on that right-wrong binary, I ask them to imagine what if they are wrong. So crack open the possibilities around what truth might look like. Like, you're applying your idea of gender violence to someone else's situation. And then I ask them to consider, is it worth the risk of being wrong? So we can lay out this idea of false reporting and the ways that false reporting is really amplified in the media is one of the most likely things that a survivor of sexual assault is doing when they come forward. And I ask them to consider, what if your perception of this event isn't the only perception, especially since you're not directly involved, right? And you're just kind of getting these impressions through the media, which is oftentimes the ways that folks learn about particular cases or gender violence if they don't have, you know, unfortunately, an intimate understanding of it. Just getting folks to consider that maybe, just maybe, there's a different perspective of what happened. Mm-hmm. What if the other person's perspective is just as valid as your own? Particularly a person who identifies as a survivor.
One thing that I constantly try to bring to the forefront to folks is that the biggest thing for me and the biggest thing that I find of usefulness to the individuals that I go and I speak to is really trying to engage with something meaningful on an everyday level. Rachel and I are going to go to this Roots of Change conference, and one conference isn't going to end gender violence. Me speaking at one school isn't going to end gender violence. If somebody reads my book, just reading my book isn't going to end gender violence. And so what I'm a huge advocate of is for individuals to find one way every day to support their local activists, to support their local women's center, to educate themselves on just small parts of this issue every day, to have conversations with individuals in your classrooms, individuals in your community, just once every day. And if we can start to create this culture where it's just these everyday micro realities where we're constantly having a constructive dialogue about this issue, that is what is really going to bring about change. It's not about big, huge speeches. It's not about keynotes. It's not about best-selling books. or really fancy websites, but it's when we can kind of take all these resources and continually talk about them and continually bring them up. And, you know, and we can circle back to this idea of pop culture. Like, pop culture is so pervasive in our lives, and the only way that we can combat some of these misunderstandings about gender violence that happen through media and happen through pop culture is to constantly bring up realities of gender violence in our everyday discussions. So we have to continue to offer this counter narrative and this counter discourse to this pop culture misinformation if we hope to elicit some sort of change. So while for all those individuals who are going to go to the Roots of Change conference, I am a big fan of networking and resourcing, but what is really going to matter is when all of us leave that pop culture conference, what are we going to do on Monday morning? What are we going to do on Tuesday morning? How are we going to take all that information we learned and how are we going to implement it on an everyday basis and engage in dialogue with our classmates, our colleagues, and our community members?
Cut the music up. A little louder.
Visit bitchmedia.org/audio to find more information about the Roots of Change conference, websites for Rachel Griffin and Josh Phillips, and links to the music videos discussed in today's podcast. I'm Sherston Johnson. Thanks again for listening.
Now you in a corner trying to put it together. How to love. How to love. For a second you were here, now you over there, it's hard not to stare. The way you moving your body like you never had a love. Never had a love.